everybody, and welcome to episode 100. Yes, episode 100. We've made it to all of the Alexis Out podcast. We were going to do all kinds of exciting features, get back all the guests we've had on, Lenny Henry, Jeremy Corbyn,
Bloody Maxine Peak.
Maxine Peak, Diane Morgan. But we haven't done any of that. I was going to do impersonations of them. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, Alexi.
Hi, Lenny.
Hi, Alexi.
I didn't even bother with that. Eh?
Why did I think they were actually going to be impressions?
Oh, no.
Of course. In your inimitable style.
Yeah.
Hi, Tig. How was it on the flotilla? What happened, Tig?
It was terrible.
Well, glad you're safe back home, Tiger.
Yeah, I am, really. Feels a bit disrespectful.
Yeah, I chose the worst possible one. Amazing to see that he's back home, but it's still shocking that so many people are still being held captive from the flotillas.
Yeah.
Especially any Arab participants. I know there were some Jordanians on the boats and stuff.
Really?
There's still a couple Irish members who are still being held. And it sounds like their treatment wasn't great, but the message they keep repeating is that if that's how they treated us, imagine how they're treating the thousands of Palestinians being held. But we come to you this week with news of ceasefires and 21-step plans to peace and a big old blah, blah, blah. What do you think? What do you make of it?
Yeah, well, I've been avoiding the mainstream media, actually, because I think it would infuriate me too much to see their interpretation of it. I mean, it's good that the killing stopped, you know. I mean, obviously there's supposed to be a ceasefire in the Lebanon, but you know, they've attacked Lebanon over 4,000 times since that supposed ceasefire has been in effect. So whether or not they will respect the Gaza ceasefire remains to be seen. But you know, I mean, they're so brave and resilient, the people in Gaza, that you know, just as we said before, you know, just existing is an act of resistance. Really, mm-hmm. I hope that something not too bad can come out of this. I don't know. We'll see, really. I mean, certainly. I mean, I think, I mean, in a sense, I mean, you know, the I mean, it's a terrible price to pay, but the boycott movement towards Israel, I think, has come on a loss. You know, it's now accepted part of dialogue. You know, the idea of Israeli genocide, the injustice of the state of Israel is come on a lot, you know. And so I suppose, you know, I mean, it's a ridiculously heavy price to pay. You know, the suffering of the Palestinian people is much for, you know, I mean, Israel is now despised around the world. I mean, I read somewhere, you know, that Israeli media is full of stories of Israelis being attacked, you know, when they're on their holidays abroad. And I mean, again, there are accounts of, you know, massive numbers of suicides and PTSD, and you know,
in the IDF
that Israel has stored up, because, you know, people who commit these atrocities, a proportion of them will suffer massively for doing that, and their economy apparently is in tatters. So it's also damaged Israel, you know. So, which is a good thing.
Like, obviously the Palestine's liberation has dominated the global conversation in a more than ever before.
Yeah.
And like you say, the price they paid can't be worth it. You know,
no,
all those lives.
Not but, really, no.
The conversation now has to, if this ceasefire holds, the conversation has to shift from genocide over to occupation and liberation.
Yeah.
Because that is the next step. The fight, if you ask me, Alexi, the fight isn't over until Palestine is free and has self-determination.
Yeah.
And right of return, and you know,
equal rights. Yeah, no, I agree.
It can't stop. You know, there's a big, tomorrow's march, we're recording this on Friday, was scheduled to be the biggest one yet.
I imagine it still will be, but I don't know.
I hope that, you know, just because this ceasefire, lots of people won't be like, oh, well, we can stay home, have that lunch we were hoping to have.
Yeah.
No, the fight's not over yet.
No, it is not. No, nowhere near, you know. But at least those things have happened, you know. And it was obviously, you know, the Palestinian struggle was being sidelined before the Abraham Accords and so on, you know. It was just
ceasefire itself is, you know, the main thing to focus on is the stopping of the killing. But
yeah,
the ceasefire itself is a continuation of occupation and of the siege of Gaza. Tight controls, restricted political activity for the Palestinians. But ceasefire and rebuilding, and, you know, as long as people don't get dispossessed and moved out of Gaza, and they get to stay and oversee the rebuilding of their town and.
Yes, indeed.
Makes me nervous, to be honest.
Yes, no, I'm not. I agree. I mean, I think I'm also, things could remain. I mean, the likelihood is, I don't know, that things will remain pretty bad, really.
Where's D-Ream when we need them?
Things can only get worse, as I always.
That's probably the ream.
Yeah.
They re-released that track.
Yeah. Well, let's hope. Maybe, I don't know. We'll see. I know it's just, I mean, because Trump wanted the Nobel Peace Prize, that Linda handed me a note saying it went to Maria Machado, who's a member of the leader of the opposition in Venezuela, and she has said that if she wins, she will move the Venezuelan embassy to Jerusalem to support Israel. So, well, the Nobel Peace Prize didn't go to Trump. It went to some other bastard. I mean, I'm no particular fan of the regime in Venezuela, but I don't think much of Maria Machado, and I can't see that she's really done much for peace. So, there you go.
It's a bit of a joke, isn't it?
Yeah. It's highly political. It's generally absurd, isn't it? The Peace Prize, really. When they gave it to Obama.
Yeah.
That time was ridiculous. But certainly Maria Machado doesn't sound like she deserves it. So I have, what's on the agenda today, Talal?
Well, we're finally, Alexei, going to do an improv scene, you and me.
You haven't told me about this. No. I was not aware of this.
I was going to actually just, to keep harking on, the your party trumpet.
Oh, right.
So I woke up this morning to a post by Zara, our right honourable friend, Zara Sultana. Yeah. There's a picture, her and Jeremy, fists in the air. We're not here to beg for crumbs off the table. We're coming for the lot. The billionaires already have three parties working for them. It's about time the rest of us had one. Join yourparty.uk today. And then the comments are all, please work with the Green Party. If your party joined the Green Party, it would be the revolution we all want. Oh, Zara, we all had such high hopes. We really did. The absolute ideal solution here would be to join up with the Greens. If you don't join up with the Greens, who already have the momentum, the political infrastructure, blah, blah, then your venture is purely egotistical. Please work with the Greens. If it really is our party, please listen to what the people are saying. Blah, blah. It's like, everyone is just pounding on this same message. And anyone who's not is just seems still very scarred from, you know, the whole hoo-ha that happened.
Yeah, it was.
And I'm kind of stuck in the middle. I do really like this new direction that the Greens seem to be going in. And apparently at the party conference, there was a lot of very socialist kind of movements voted in and stuff. So but I haven't cancelled my membership yet of the Your Party. I'm holding out till the November conference.
I think we have to really see what happens with that. I mean, I agree they've done a brilliant job, Zara and Jeremy, of dissipating all that enthusiasm and excitement.
So heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking. I mean, I would just say, that idea that, you know, that like Andrew has in here in Camden and of having a party with a different structure, you know, a democratic structure from the bottom up, you know, is still something I think that would be worth trying, really. As far as I know about the structure of the Green Party, it's structured as a conventional party. So, I think we have to wait until the conference in November and see what emerges from that, really.
Because it could emerge that that is the decision, is that they should merge with the Greens. Like, that could be what everyone votes for, because that's the whole point of the conference, is that they're going to listen to, they're going to have motions that were created by the members. They're going to listen to what the members' opinions are and then hold votes. And so that could just be where it all ends up.
I think it's possible, yeah. I mean, it does seem a ready-made. I don't know. I mean, I'm not. It does seem like a ready-made solution in a way. So, but I'd like something which is explicitly more socialist myself. But
me too, and that's kind of, yeah, I said it before. Like, that is the thing that got them as well, is that they were too democratic, and that's, they were acting. Well, maybe not, actually, no, because it's quite a...
Well, it wasn't democratic.
No, well, it was just her on her own releasing the link.
Well, but, yeah.
But she was trying to just accelerate the memberships.
The joining process, up and stuff. Yeah, because you feel like you...
But I don't know, yeah. You know, we give them benefit of the doubt over and over again. And I've got a couple more to give them. I do.
Yeah. They spoke together, didn't they, at St. George's Hall?
Yes, I think that's where the
Wi-Fi failed.
Really?
Yeah. But there is I don't know whether that's sabotage or just probably incompetent. Or just, you know, bad luck. But I think there is a recording. But they did appear together. I've actually seen no reports of what went on there, but... it'd be interesting to know.
Well, I at the same time, you know, I really like Zach as well, and I actually, just on an individual basis, I like his character and his personality.
He's very good at with the media, you know.
Yeah. But we were last week in our show in Shoreham. Which thank you everyone for all the lovely comments and messages about that show. I had a lot of fun, but. We had a bit of banter at Zach's expense because I brought up the story of 12 years ago, he got caught by an undercover journalist who basically he offered her, he was a hypnotherapist at the time, and he offered her a session where he could hypnotize her boobs bigger, basically. That's the story, and that's how the story was presented. And
yeah.
And we were having a bit of a laugh about that, but I got this interesting email from Nicola, which I'll just read to you now. Hi there, Alexi and Talal. Please research about Zach and hypnotherapy. He has been misrepresented. He was asked to do this hypnotherapy, said it wouldn't work, but they insisted. So he agreed to do it without payment on the understanding that he would not normally do this. And didn't think it would work. Now he is having the Sun's false reporting thrown at him. I heard this on an interview with maybe Navarra, but I haven't been able to find it to send to you. Okay. It's really important to challenge the right wing's stories about left wing parties and not perpetuate their myths. The Greens The Greens are an increasingly important voice now that your party have squandered what was a great moment with enormous potential by having their disagreements in public. A very sad time. Hope you can apologize for this in the next podcast and maybe get Zach on the show at some point.
Be happy to have Zach on the show. And yes, I mean, she's right, actually. I mean, you shouldn't take these. I mean, you know, the Sun is, all the newspapers, particularly the right-wing ones, are full of lies, so I suppose we shouldn't really. And that does sound typical of a kind of stitch-up that they would do, really.
And as we should know, yeah, exactly, yeah, like what so we went through with Jeremy and everything, like we should know that the centrists and the rights will do anything to make our people look bad, isn't it? Why do I feel like a teacher like really just scolded me and made me stand in the corner?
We perhaps did fall below the high standards we set ourselves on this podcast, you know. So, that sounds all too believable that is what would happen, really. It is typical of what the Sun would do. Why were they targeting him back then?
No, they were targeting him now by digging up that old.
I know, but why did they target him back then? Since he wasn't anybody back then, was he?
That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, whether they were just going after all hypnotherapy, I don't, you know.
Maybe they were doing an expose on hypnotherapy. Yeah,
maybe. Yeah, it's odd they targeted him. I'm sure we could look more into that. And
yeah, I will report back to you once I find out.
Yeah.
But sorry, Nicola. Sorry, Zach.
Yeah, sorry, everybody.
I just wanted to... hear Alexi say boobs. That's why I did it. You know? I got a question for you.
Yes.
What is a skill that you don't have that you would wish you could learn or you could have?
I'd like to be able to sing properly, even though I've had a top 20 hit single. I'd like to be able to. I'd like to have a lovely voice. I mean, unless we're talking absurd skills like flying or, you know, heat rays.
Meant skills. Like you would need some sort of physical transmutation on your voice box in order to have a lovely singing voice.
Yeah. I mean, you could kind of learn how to, but when we do songs on Sandwich Bar, for instance, the recording does take quite long. We often do them sort of line by line, really.
Oh, really?
Tim takes me, or, you know, certainly verse by verse, because I'll just wander off. Tim has to take me through it. He's like, no, it goes, you know. Tim Sutton, who does the songs, has to painstakingly take me through it, really.
Okay.
Unless it is, I think the one we did on the last series was more a kind of spoken thing. So it didn't require quite as much singing. But, yeah, I mean, for instance, the theme song, you know.
Yeah, it sounds so beautiful.
My sandwich bar, bags of bargain prices. Yeah, I mean, I think that took quite a long time to record.
Right. Okay. Okay, good answer.
Yeah.
But what about something with like your hands or something a bit like juggling or something like that? Like a skill
Not particularly. I don't know. It's not. I've never noticed the lack of really. Singing is really the one I would. Singing and playing a musical instrument, I suppose. I mean, I was always very jealous because it's a music. I mean, when we had a house in Spain, it was winter and we were on the beach at Salobreña. And two kind of gypsies came along singing a song. And all the Spanish people in the women, I think, mostly joined in with this song about Maria from Salobreña. But they're all in perfect, you know, harmony and pitch. I mean, they all sang it completely professionally, you know. I mean, and it was extraordinary, you know, whereas I think in Britain it would just be people, you know, singing, but not it'd be pretty raucous noise, really. But yeah, they all sang it beautifully, and it was a heart-stopping moment.
Everywhere, oh, she offers me protection.
Yeah,
that's how the English groups.
Yeah,
it's very, very much built into the culture in Europe and the Middle East and
singing. Yeah,
all over most properly, of the world. Yeah. Learning to sing from when you're young, learning these traditional songs and stuff.
Yeah, because not something we have at all, and. Yeah,
it would have
really impressive.
50 years ago or so, or even more, perhaps. But
yeah, but I always thought, I mean, like Dr. Robert, our friend in the village, you know, from the Blow Monkeys, he could. One of the ways he got in with the Spaniards was because he could play guitar, you know.
Right.
And they always, you know, they would always respect that, really. Whereas I couldn't really do stand up. I hate Keir Starmer. Okay, yeah, you know, it's not the same. It's not the same kind of transferable skill, really.
Lee in the Patreon says, "I saw Alexi last night comparing for slapstick benefit. Speaking of your stand-up, Alexi, it was great to see him bring his dance moves. I was amazed at how quick he got up off his knees. He's more than a decade older than me, and I would have needed 10 minutes." I spoke to you about it. It was a show with Stuart Lee and.
Says here, Mayor's Alistair Beckett King and Arthur Smith. It was really good. It was a great benefit. I mean, I kept things. It's the only stand up I've done like this year, I think. I kept things bubbling along. But also, it was quite good that there were only four acts, really. You know, I mean, compared to that. Yeah, you know, these, I mean, particularly Palestinian benefits that just go on for hours, you know. Because, yes. I mean, hey, fair enough, everybody wants to be on the bill and show their support, but, you know, they just grind. This was like a tight couple of hours. Everybody did their best material, and it was great, you know.
And how did it feel for you just to be doing stand up again, you know?
Felt fantastic. Yeah, felt really fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoyed it when I was out. Yeah. I was just nice being backstage with everybody and just also doing it, you know, being out there. And big, I mean, I think, I don't know how many there was there, about maybe 850 or something, you know, but working a big crowd. I mean, they were a lovely audience. They were very nice.
Well, I'm proud of you, my son.
Thank you.
It's good to see you back out there on the pitch.
Yeah.
Let's get you doing more, man.
Yeah.
Or would you ever consider running, or like me running, a monthly stand-up night somewhere local to you?
I don't really know. I mean, it's
we call it Alexi Sales Comedy Club or something, and you and me could host it, or I'll take care of all the admin.
It'd be a way to we could think about it. It'd be a way to generate new material, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, the Museum of Comedy is the obvious,
of course.
But it's worth a thought. Yeah, I have. Yeah, not this week, but yeah.
No, but I just thought of it now. That could be cool.
Yeah.
Alexi Sales Imaginary Stand-Up Club or something. And we could just book comedians that we like and that we agree with politically. Yeah.
Well, that's how I started out, really. When I got back into it, I did four shows, I think, at Soho Theatre with, you know, people like Josie Long and various acts who were on the circuit in those days. And, you know, it was a way for me to sort of ease my way back. And then I did bits in between them. Long time ago now, like 2012 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's how I got back into it, really.
I remember that's how, that's the first time I kind of hung out with you as an adult, was coming to that show with
That's right. I mean, that wasn't the...
No, it was your full show. It was your first full return.
That was great. That was really great.
And you were like, I think the big gag was that... you're like, all my material used to be about Thatcher.
Yes.
But now I could still do that same material and just say David Cameron instead. And there was a big section of that where you were clearly doing Margaret Thatcher jokes. But just saying David Cameron.
About Dizzy Rascal. I can't remember how it went now. Some people think I'm crazy aunties. Yeah, I can't remember how it went now.
And then you took my family to the Groucho Club afterwards down the road.
Yeah.
And then we all kind of just sat awkwardly because you don't chat much when you're not on stage.
No, like, well, especially that, you know, just come off stage.
Similar to my dad.
Oh, thank you very much. You fucking abandoned me in Brixton after rope tackle. You drove me to Brixton and then threw me out. I had to go home all right. Thank you very much.
I'm glad to hear it.
You left me in Brixton at midnight.
Yeah, with all the crazies out there.
Yeah, elderly man.
I thought you'd fit in quite well in Brixton and I went, on a Saturday night.
It was weird. I went, because it's the end of Victoria Line. And
Wait. Just to clarify for the audience, we finished in Shoreham. You were going to get the train home.
Yeah.
But you were going to, you jumped in the car with me back to London.
Yeah.
And if I was to drive you to your door, it would have added almost an hour to my journey because I live in South London and you live closer to Central.
Yeah.
And you suggested I could just throw you out of Brixton so because it was a very easy train ride home.
Yeah.
And now you're making me feel awful about it. So, yeah, what happened,
that's
Alexei?
Deliberate. I went and there's two platforms because that's the end of the line. The trains pull in and then they go out. And so I went to – I was a bit – tired and confused. I went and there was a few people.
God, I should have taken you.
They should have taken me onto the platform, really. There's a few people sort of sitting waiting for trains, but there wasn't going to be any train for like 20 minutes. I don't know what they were doing there.
Oh, really?
And then I realized all the trains were leaving from the other platform, so I missed one. I think I only missed one. And then I went through and...
Is that it? I thought you were going to tell me more thrilling.
No,
I quite like traveling in London at night with all the drunks and stuff, like the night buses and the tube. Yes, occasionally you'll get like really annoying, someone really annoying next to you, but mostly it's just kind of, you're just seeing life happening around you and laughter and
groups of people
who
are
having great nights. And like you mentioned Brecht's idea of the theatre of the street and all that, and that's it, like turned up to 11, you know, it's... It can be really fun.
It was not, you know, it was not leery in any way at all. Everybody was happy.
I can't say I didn't feel guilty at all. Like, I felt bad leaving you there.
Abandoning me, because it wasn't even by the stairs. I had to walk. I was about 5 minutes away from the station.
Oh, come on, don't exaggerate.
I had to walk to the station.
And you got out of the car and you dropped your car keys. And you almost walked off, and I could have let you just walk off and leave your car keys on the floor.
Yeah. But you didn't. And on the way, I got the Elizabeth line to Reading for the Hexagon show because my Freedom Pass.
Mm.
This is a tip for all you elderly. Your Freedom Pass works as far as Reading on the Elizabeth
line. No way.
A man gave me a seat.
Oh.
Which was very kind. On the because it was busy on the outbound journey. I got like 5 o'clock train to Reading.
Did you see Alistair Beckett King's set?
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
He's good, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
I gigged with him very early on, and he is just blown up. He did it the right way because he got really good at stand up and he's very intelligent. You know, some people might think it's a bit hoity toity, but he's funny as fuck. But he got really good at stand up and then. He blew up on social media, making very clever videos. He's like a master at these. He does special effects and on these incredibly tightly edited videos, and he's playing all the parts, and he does all these costumes and hair and special effects and animation, and he does it all himself. It's quite mind-blowing, which then, you know, blew up his status, and then he got better and better gigs out of it, but he was already good at stand-up. A lot of these people, they just get really big on social media and then they get booked to do shows and they suck live because they don't know what they're doing.
Alistair
smashed it.
I've seen him on YouTube before, but he was good, you know, very very skilled, good material.
All right, I got a question on Patreon. Patreones,
yeah,
really enjoyed the last episode. This is from Wallow. Really enjoyed last episode, especially Alexei's justification of being caught quaffing champagne. But please, can you check something with him? In the mid-1980s, I used to spend my weekends at my grandma's house in Kirkdale. I'm convinced that on one occasion, I was in the back of my dad's car, driving up Everton Valley, and I noticed what I thought was Alexei walking along the roadside. He gave me a funny look. I was about 10 at the time, before when carrying on. In the mid-80s. Could it possibly have been him?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because my mum lived in Anfield and Linda's parents lived on Scotland Road, so I would have walked down Everton Valley to go between the two of them. So, yeah, it's perfectly possible that I was walking down Everton Valley, yeah.
Look at that wallow.
Yeah. Interestingly, there's a very successful American writer called Jim Vallely. Look him up now.
Yes, sir. Jim Vallely. American producer and screenwriter. Yeah, Jim Vallely. Yeah. Got him.
And what's he done?
American television producer and screenwriter. He's written and produced for The Golden Girls.
Well, that's what, but later. But what's
Two and a Half Men, My Wife and Kids. I love My Wife and Kids. Movies and shows. Double Trouble, Brotherly Love, Running Wild, Arrested Development.
Arrested Development, yes, yeah.
What are you looking for? What do you want me to say?
Well, no, because he's heard the podcast. He's heard me talking about Golden Palace, and he's ringing me this evening to tell me what, from the States, to tell me what really went on, which is not what I think went on.
What, it wasn't to do with tomatoes?
It was not, apparently, on me, no, on my bad tap dancing.
can't we record this conversation?
Well, I don't know, really. I didn't really want to ask him whether he just seems to want to talk on the phone.
Well, can you ask him what it was like making Surf Ninjas with Leslie Nielsen in 1993, please?
Okay. I'm speaking to him at 6 anyway.
Oh, my God. Okay, you're going to fill us in next week, right? I need you to take extensive notes so that you don't forget a single detail.
Yeah. It's nice that he listens to the podcast.
Very nice. Hello, Jim. Thanks for listening.
I thought it was Mitch Hurwitz from Arrested Development. You said I got standing ovation in the pilot. But in a way, I mean, it did. I don't know what would have happened, really. I mean, it did. I mean, I came back to the UK and then I was... Jim Moyer, the head of comedy, was very nice to me, and I did two more very good series with Graham and Arthur writing. So I did come back to the UK, but I don't know what would have happened really if I stayed in the States I don't really know. It did affect me really. I mean, getting fired from that show on my 40th birthday.
Oh, buddy.
I know. Yeah.
Well, look, Jim, Valerie, if you're listening, I'm a jobbing actor, and if you brought me to America to cast me in something, I would behave very well. I could fill that Alexei-shaped hole.
I think the circus has moved on.
We had another thing I need to address from last week's show, if you don't mind, Alexei.
Yeah, sure.
We were talking about Riyadh Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we fell on the side of, you know, it's not right to take state, you know, government money to go and do a state-sponsored comedy show in an oppressive country. But I think yesterday, Omid Jalili wrote an article in The Guardian about it.
Yeah.
There was some chat in the Patreon chat room about it. Mark showed us a conversation Omid was having with a commenter on his Instagram. Someone was asking him, how could you be doing this festival? And he said, it's very important I do this festival and you'll find out why soon. I'm going to write about it. And he has written about it in The Guardian.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. It echoes a bit of the kind of, I made the devil's advocate counterpoint last week. There are echoes of that there. But do you want me to read it to you and you can interrupt me?
I read it, but yeah, you can read it again to me.
Read it to our listeners. Please interject.
About 8 articles about the Riyadh Comedy Festival in The Guardian. This is something they get their teeth into.
I bet, yeah. Well, it's been in the zeitgeist very, in a very bigly fashion. All right, here's Omid in The Guardian. After 15 years of turning down offers to perform stand-up in Saudi Arabia due to the country's human rights record, this time I took the gig. Why? There's a push for change in Saudi and signs are discernible, yet many from the outside would rather comedians in the West stayed away. At a time when freedom of speech is under attack, the backlash against comedians who participated in the Riyadh Comedy Festival reflects our ongoing struggle to find consensus on this and many issues affecting humanity. I'm no stranger to cancel culture. I was cancelled after 9/11 simply for being Middle Eastern, as Arab terrorists were behind the attacks on the Twin Towers. This is despite the fact that I'm not Arab, nor am I, contrary to popular opinion, a terrorist. we'll stop playing Arabs then. Where's the next slide? There we go. In certain circles, there have been calls to boycott my UK tour, Namaste, a show in which I try to explore the nuances, blah, blah, blah. After explaining that the restrictions on performing in Saudi were exactly the same as in Dubai, basically no jokes about the royals, no disrespecting Islam, and no humiliation of the government, a concerned friend texted me, "I think you're at risk of invalidating your right to make jokes about anything important." My show in Riyadh had a lot of material about the Saudis themselves. The perception that we, as comedians, were all being paid to be silent was as laughable as the idea that Dave Chappelle, worth $70 million, was doing his show in Riyadh for the money. Any thoughts?
Yet? Well, yeah, I'm reluctant to. Obviously, Ahmed's, you know, friend of the show, and, I don't think there is much positive. I mean, from what I've read in The Guardian, again, there doesn't seem to be a lot of, like, movement in many ways in Saudi Arabia towards, you know, I mean, they're still executing. They're still executing, you know, satirists and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know. As I say, it's not for me to.
He is a tricky one. He is a friend.
Yeah, he's a friend. And
but, you know, he's really putting this out there, so it's...
I think the Saudi government seems to be incredibly repressive, and that this festival was an effort to, you know, comedy wash that without really changing their nature. I don't know. From what I've read in The Guardian, I would, you know, maybe somebody else, some expert could tell me that things are.
Well, he mentions different. That Dubai is a very different place now to what it was when he first performed there in 2008, largely because of the import of culture and performance and stuff.
Like, yeah.
And that, you know, allowing international performances in Saudi, especially comedy, it subtly broadens what's thinkable and sayable in society. Every laugh at a taboo subject shifts norms. Okay, that is a good point.
Yeah. I mean, somebody made the point again that 2% of, apparently 2% of the population are actual literal slaves. I mean, I saw Nish Patel and they're from the Indian subcontinent talking about this on YouTube. Mm. There is literal slavery in Saudi Arabia. So, that's a problem. I also have just disclosed as well that not a Saudi Comedy Festival, but Newcastle United have been after me to play a central midfield role, and I've turned that down as well. I'm not going to play for Newcastle United.
Why wouldn't you do that?
Well, because they're owned by the Saudis. Okay. That's the only reason. The only reason I won't play central midfield in that false number 9 sweeper running the channels, sweeper keeper role. The only reason that I won't do that is because Newcastle United is owned by the Saudi government.
Well,
so, yeah. So you'll be.
That's very righteous of you, and I don't.
Thank you.
Ahmed would do it if he was offered that.
Play position. For Newcastle United.
Yeah. Because, you know, he's made a couple of good points, but I think the bad points outweigh.
I think, you know, it's
he mentions that the government, you have to remember that governments are not their people, but this was a government funded event.
Yeah. It's not. Yeah. Yeah. Film Club.
Film Club.
So I finally watched Battle for Algiers.
Yeah, okay, let's do it. This is the first time I've not watched the film.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, the Battle for Algiers, I hope all the listeners have watched it now.
I know we've delayed
it a bit.
Yeah, I think a lot of them have watched it and forgotten all about it.
Yeah.
And you, sneaky little ninja, watched it without telling me, Alexei.
Yeah.
So tell us about
I think it's Battle for Algiers. It's a... directed by Pontecorvo in the Italian new wave, new neo-realist style. Music by Ennio Morricone. And it's a kind of, it's an account of the sort of the FLN struggle in Algiers. I mean, of a kind of a cell of or a group of the FLN who are gradually kind of rolled up by the French, Mathieu, the French paratrooper commander. Really interesting film, though. I mean, like, Mathieu makes the point that, you know, a lot of them, people call them colonialists, but a lot of them, you know, fought in the resistance, and some of them had actually survived Dachau and Buchenwald concentration camps. I was surprised because there's quite an extended passage where the FLN are planting bombs in cafes and milk bars where people are dancing the twist. And so it was shocking, really. I think, I don't know the first time I saw it, but it seemed deeply shocking that those kind of actions, really, of killing and stuff is. I'd assumed also that the FLN were, without knowing anything about Algeria, that the FLN were, you know, secular and Marxist like the PLO, but in fact they are, from, I think one sees in this film that they are Islamist, or they are quite... You know, they are relatively Islamist. So,
tell us about the FLN. You know, you have to talk.
I don't know anything
like
about the Front Liberation National. I don't know anything about. I mean, they were just. I mean, I've done no research and know nothing about the Algerian struggle for liberation. Really, I mean, apart from how it impinged on France.
National Liberation Front.
National Liberation Front.
Or the Front de Liberation Nationale. Nationalist political party in Algeria. It's the main nationalist movement during the Algerian War and the sole legal and ruling party of the Algerian state.
Yeah, pretty repressive now, isn't it? I mean, like
until 1989,
I mean, like all those liberation movements, they all, as soon as they got into power, like the ANC or the PLO or... they all instantly became both corrupt and autocratic, really. So there's that going on. I think it's still pretty... I think there's the way... I know there was a very unpleasant civil war in the 90s, I'm thinking, which really, really cruel Islamist groups who I think were eventually put down by the government. I mean, I think that, you know, you could say the trauma of that. I mean, it was a really savage war of colonial. The French were pretty brutal, although the Israelis made them look like top-hatted gentlemen or knights of, you know, chivalric knights of old. But, I mean, it seems pretty... But interestingly enough, there is this... Have you seen the movie that everybody's talking about is One Battle at a Time?
One
battle after another, yeah.
Haven't watched it yet.
Leonardo DiCaprio, Paul Thomas Anderson, of whom I am a fan, with amazing movies like
Yeah, he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's really worth seeing.
I'm just put off by Johnny Greenwood being involved, you know.
Well, I think, you know, I think that's cutting your nose off to spite your nose, really. I mean, it's, I think, you know, really, it's not, it's a really interesting film, but also there is one scene, I think, in, where the police, maybe raid Leonardo DiCaprio is watching. I think it's Leonardo DiCaprio is watching the TV, and he's watching the battle for Algiers. And so there's a clearly a kind of reference there to that film. And it is, in a way, I mean, the thing Paul Thomas Anderson does of having the music very high up in the mix, you know, and in a way that really propels the action. I think is also. You see that in, Pontecorvo uses that in Battle for Algiers. It's really interesting film, really, and it's...
Tell us a bit about Pontecorvo's kind of filmmaking. How is it shot?
Well, I think that, I mean, there was I'm really pushing it. I should have done some research, and then I'd... People have been more impressed with me. I mean, my understanding is that there was in the immediate post-war years in Italy, there was this new wave of kind of neorealism. Italian neorealism. The most obvious example of that is Bicycle Thieves.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did, from this is all from my memory, is that they would often use real people, would use real situations. So there's never, they're always shot on location. There's never any use of sets. And it's an attempt to really to get at the, I think it's an attempt to kind of get at reality in movie making, really, is to like you say, a kind of realism rather than film, you know, movie being a kind of, you know, softly lit fable, or these are films that attempt to replicate reality, you know. I mean,
it was often about class as well, like they would tell lower class, working class people's stories. People, you know, they tell the story of the majority of the population.
People who got the bus, I think. Is that, yeah.
It was kind of almost documentary style.
Yeah.
Filmmaking.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of handheld camera and grainy. I mean, I don't know whether they shot them on 16mm or 35, but who directed Bicycle Thieves? I've forgotten.
Vittorio De Sica.
Vittorio De Sica, right.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, you also got that. I mean, Fellini is, of course, is very different. I mean, it's a kind of dreamy kind of, you know, magical quality about Fellini's films, which are very much a contrast to the neorealism of De Sica and Pontecorvo.
Right.
But I think it's a film that's. A friend of mine who is a psychoanalyst or psychotherapist. They used to have a film club, which was held at Freud's house, which is also a museum. And
I've been there.
Yeah, the gift shop's hilarious, isn't it? You can buy all kinds of Freud themed slippers and stuff like that.
I don't remember the gift shop.
Yeah, but they had a film club there, and it was hosted by the person showing Battle for Algiers. Was somebody who taught at the war studies, I think, at Bradford University at the time, or peace studies. And I remember him using the phrase, which I'm very fond of, and I think I've used before, is engrenage, which is a French phrase, which literally means getting dragged into the machinery. But it's kind of, you know, what happens in a struggle. You know, you start out, like the American... United States involvement in Vietnam, you start out very small and you gradually, events kind of drag you until you're involved in a large scale conflict, you know.
Right.
But I think engrenage is a very useful phrase for So something to watch out for is, you know, getting yourself dragged into the machinery, you know, getting involved in some debate or that, you know, you didn't really intend to get involved in, really. But you find yourself forced into taking a position, for example.
I've just found a quote from the movie. "It's hard to start a revolution, even harder to continue it, and hardest of all to win it. But it's only afterwards, when we have won, that the true difficulties begin. In short, Ali, there's still much to do."
Yes, that's the main boss talking to the sort of center. If there is a central figure, it's a guy, this guy Ali Lapointe, who starts out as a small petty criminal and is gradually drawn into the revolutionary struggle and ends up dying when the French blow up the house that he's in.
Jeez.
But yeah, that's what the head says to him.
So, as is quite typical, this is a revolution that results in a long running dictatorship kind of thing, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, that's not what the film is saying. Obviously, the film was made in 1966.
No,
the film
is just the revolution bit.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, they got their independence from France in 62, so a lot of the people, presumably, in the film had been involved in the liberation struggle. It was only 4 years afterwards that it was made, so it was all very, very rare. There's one shot towards the end where there's a Soviet, I think it's like a Soviet sort of tank, which is not a tank,
I forget what
they're called, tank destroyer.
Yeah, this is listed as one of the goofs in the film.
Yeah, I spotted it immediately. I thought, what's that doing there? Because it's...
I was waiting for you to say this.
Yeah,
during the big protest at the end, the police, the French police, are backed by armored vehicles. They are Soviet-made Su-100 tank destroyers.
Yeah.
These were part of the Algerian military when the film was made in 1966 after independence, but wouldn't have been present or used by the French at any time.
No, it does. I mean, obviously, most people wouldn't notice, but it did really stand
out. Drags you out of it, doesn't it?
It's clearly a Soviet piece of equipment. Somebody in the comments said, "I'm a reactionary for supporting the 88. They support the 120mm gun in the IS-2, the Soviet.
In the comments from our show last week.
Yeah, YouTube or the week before. Yeah. But I think the 120mm in the IS-2, the Joseph Stalin 2 tank, had, I don't know, two-part ammunition, so it had a very, very slow rate of fire. So I'll stick with,
Really did, yeah.
I'll stick with the 88 if you don't mind. And the gun, the most common gun in is this French submachine gun, 9mm submachine gun, the MAT-49 is what the revolutionaries steal them from the French police. And there's some M1 carbines and some French bolt-action rifles.
Mm.
But the most common gun is the MAT-49. But it's funny, somebody actually noticed the Soviet piece of equipment there, yeah.
One more thing about Italian neorealism I think is interesting. I want to point out, I've just read here that it came about from at the end of the war, World War II, the Italian movie industry was like obliterated after Mussolini fell. And so it came out of necessity, this creativity that, you know, they were starting from the ground up. They didn't have the big access to the big studios, special effects, which, you know, Hollywood had influenced over the decades, you know, that cinema technique of, you know, using massive sound stages, amazing lighting, as you mentioned, and all this. And then, you know, in an instant, that's all gone. So what do we do now? We still want to make movies. We want to tell our stories, and we're working class, and we want, and so they just had a camera, the sun as their lighting, and the streets, you know, and created this whole movement, which some of, you know, cinema's finest work, some finest, most iconic movies have come out of. And I think that's just kind of a beautiful thing about how, you know, necessity breeds creativity. And that's like a really, really nice example of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And even you know, after a couple decades, where they still have regained access to better effects and techniques, you know, the movement carried on through to the late 60s, maybe. Yeah. So pretty cool, Lex.
Yeah, good for them. Well done.
I got a package. I got a very nice care package. Look at this golden packaging. All right. And you've been talking about myths quite a lot lately.
Mm.
Okay. I had a listener of the show reach out to us. Hi, Talal. I'm a long-time listener of the podcast, and based on the recent mythology content, thought I'd reach out. Me and my partner run a side project. He's a state school teacher, and she's a video games journalist. And they trying to democratize the study of ancient history and mythology.
Right.
It's called Working Classicist. The project is 50% fueled by our love of the subjects and 50% by a visceral hatred of private schools and educational inequality. Our first book, A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, was published this year and gave platform to more than 100 working class writers. A total anomaly in the world of classics. They sent me two copies.
That sounds interesting. It's true. My impersonation of Stephen Fry usually just goes, blah, 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 Cicero, blah, blah, blah. Punic Wars, blah, 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 blah.
So here it is. It's huge.
Wow.
A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, Working Classicists, edited by Miri Teixeira. Teixeira. Is that a Baskin name?
Could be.
And he wrote me a letter here, which I'm going to pass on to you, Alexi.
Thank you.
Because we've been shown lots of interest in mythology recently.
Yeah.
And he starts off saying, like, I'm just going to write you this little note, and then it ends up being 6 pages long. He says, I got a bit carried away at the end. And he also included a copy of Michael Parenti's Marxist interpretation of the murder of Julius Caesar. It's sensational.
Sounds interesting.
So I might pass that on to you as well.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Enjoy the book. Keep up the excellent work. Freedom for Palestine. I don't want to read this whole letter, but it's very nice. But basically, why is the classics only reserved for the upper class and for people in private schools? Why isn't not necessarily just Latin, but just access to mythology that whole area of history?
I agree. Yeah, these are the myths of our society.
There genuinely is in the book. If you were a patron, you'd be able to see what I'm holding up for the screen and stuff. But there is a periodic table of Greek myths. And, you know, if I just go to a random page, so Odysseus, and it's like each Greek myth has its own page. It's kind of just distilled down. Very accessible, very easy to digest. I've been flicking through. Basically, I'll sit with my partner and I'll say stop while I flick through the book, and we'll just learn about a different myth each day. It's lovely. It's really nicely put together, presented. It's a periodic table of Greek mythology. So thank you, George and Miri, for sending us that. Please support the show. Go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. We want to do 100 more of these, don't we, Alexis?
Yeah, we do. Certainly do.
And we don't ever want to have adverts on the show. And so we are fully reliant on your generous support.
Patreon and Edge.
Patronage. So go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. Please don't use the Patreon app on your iPhone. They take a massive cut, and they don't take it from us. They take it from you. So you pay more to join on Apple app, on the iPhone app. I don't understand how they get away with this, but they add their own surcharge onto the membership. Just go to the website. Even on your iPhone, go into your web browser and go to the website. patreon.com/letssailpodcast. Sign up there. I think by the time this podcast drops, I'll have finished our second episode of Alexi, Lisa, and Nigel Watch the Young Ones. You're watching episode 2 of The Young Ones. I will never post that on YouTube because it will get copyright banned and all that. And it's a really fun one. It's really nice.
Yeah.
That's the plug I need to say.
All right, then. Well, I think we're done for this 100th edition.
What a thrilling 100th edition, yeah. Alexi.
Yeah, it was.
Could it be any more gripping?
It's hard to imagine how.
I can't imagine. Maybe we could shout out some new patrons, I just realized. We've had some new patrons join up, like Robert, Rachel, and Paul, and Sally, and Tompkins. Oh, Tom Tompkins. Sorry, I said your full name. Hello, all of you, and Tobias. Hello. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
What have you got to say to them?
So much. So much. Thank you so much. So much.
All right, Lex, anything else?
No, I think that's we've covered the waterfront for today. I'll just say bye-bye. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Alexi Sail Podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexisailpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.